This is the TSN MMA show with Aaron Bronstetter and Bazooka Joe Valtellini.
Whitaker withdraws. Steven stops Superboy. Two tall titans clash at UFC 220 this weekend. Dana White drops some hints for 2018. And Hurricane Shane Burgos joins us, as does our friend Robin Black, who will be discussing UFC 220 with us. Joe, you have a good weekend?
Yeah, it was good. Nice and relaxing. A lot of good training and some good fights. I was really impressed with the fights yesterday, so I'm excited to talk about it.
I thought there were some good fights, some high points, some low points in the card. But, you know, I thought the main event was fantastic, Stevens and Duho Choi. We were discussing it a little bit off the air, and I'd really love to hear your take on it from, like, a technical standpoint. You know, I thought that it was interesting that Stevens was really able to shift the momentum of the fight in that second round, because it seemed like Duho was having his way with him in the first.
Yeah, it was a very technical fight, and what made the fight so good was Duho came out with amazing distance control, and that was the key to the fight, that every time Stevens threw, he was able to move back and create space, which we call distance control, and distance control in fighting is very important, whether you're pressing forward. That's controlling the space between you and your opponent. Or if I'm backing up and moving, I'm still controlling that space. So in the case, Duho was hitting and moving, which was working well because, you know, Stevens is known for that one big punch power. So he knew that he was able to kind of hit and move and was successful in the first round. Stevens was trying to close distance with his footwork, wasn't so successful in the first round, but the adjustment he made in the second round was really important to see. And what happened was he started closing distance before throwing that big shot. He started using setup punches, not as to do damage, but just to close distance, then to shift his feet and to hit. And what I was explaining to you, Aaron, was that the shifting footwork he does is what makes it so good, is that what shifting is when you actually start in one stance and end up in the other stance. So you start orthodox and end up in southpaw. And that's the easiest way to close so much space in the fastest amount of time, rather than staying either in your orthodox and your southpaw and, like, shuffling or galloping over that shift. So that's what one of his biggest successful weapons is, closing that distance down with his hand, and then he just started doing it. And with Duho Choi, what was happening after he got caught, his human nature started coming out, where he wanted to punch back, he wanted to counter back. So that worked right into Stevens, where Steven was able to touch him, set him up. As Duho Choi went to counter, boom, Steven beat him with that power punch, and that was just vicious. The way he popped up Duho Choi's head like that was just vicious power, man.
He's the only person to ever finish Duho Choi.
Yeah, and that power.
In the second round, yeah.
Yeah, they call it the Pez dispenser. He Pez dispensed his head.
Yeah.
Like, it was just that rocking
like
head.
And Overeem, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's why a lot of these fighters, they got to do a lot more neck work. A lot of fighters ignore the neck work, but it's so important. With those kind of shots, you know, no matter how hard it is, you got to protect your neck that way, because your brain shakes a lot more when your head snaps like that. So
what's neck work? Explain that.
Neck work would be like, it's a little simple exercise you can do before or after training. So like say you're laying on your side and you do like neck crunches forward, backwards. Some guys, you'll see, a lot of guys in Thailand, you'll see bite the towel and they'll put it around the weight. And then from biting the towel, they'll move their head back and forward just to strengthen the muscles in the neck. So this time when you take a punch and you brace your neck to take a shot, like, you can at least control your neck so your neck doesn't snap and cause more of that whiplash effect in the brain. So they say good strong neck and traps will help support your neck and help with injuries. That's the theory. Some people say it could be worse. I actually fought a fighter by the name of Ben Case. He was a really tall southpaw, and he had what we called rubber neck, which you would think is kind of weird, where he'd hit you, but he'd roll with the hook, for example. If you hit his chin with the hook, he'd roll his head, so it didn't do too much damage. So we called that rubber neck. I had a hard time knocking someone like that out.
So it goes with the momentum of the punch.
Yeah, so it kind of flows with it, so the brain doesn't shake as much. I mean, I find tall fighters tend to do that because they lean back and they're good at it, but, I mean, majority of the time, like, a strong neck and traps will help that. So Duho, get on his neck work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, he might have a lot of time to do that in the military, because apparently he's up for his 2-year mandatory military service.
Yeah,
in
I think
South
that's
Korean.
Crazy. Yeah, I think that's crazy. Even like his colleague in the beginning of the fight, right?
Yeah,
Came back after 2 years. Yeah, I kept an eye on that. You really called him out last show, saying he's someone to watch out for, and he looked good.
He looked very good. That triangle. I mean, the way that he transitioned to that triangle was really impressive. You know, he had top control, but he saw the opening. I guess he was in full mount. He saw the opening. opening for the triangle. It's rare that you see guys go from full mount onto their back.
Yeah.
And he was that confident in his triangle that he made it happen. And you saw Kennedy was going to go for the slam and realize this thing's just going to get tighter if I do that.
Oh, yeah, he squeezed that really tight and gave up. But, yeah, he looked good. Impressive. Yeah.
Well, you know, one of my favorite fighters to watch, Kyung Ho Kang. If you can go back and watch a lot of his fights, he's won some, lost some, but he's always in it and he's always exciting. And, you know, really, really stubbly grappler. You haven't seen a lot of triangles lately, I've noticed, in the UFC.
Yeah,
it seemed like it was a much more dangerous weapon, but people have learned how to get out of them. But those who have mastered it, those who are really good at executing it off their backs.
Yeah, I can't remember the last time I saw a triangle. You're right.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems that they aren't as effective as they used to be because people just learn the defense. But I guess Kennedy, you know, he's been off for 2 years due to a suspension, and I don't know if he just hasn't drilled that or if it was just that tight. I mean, when you're getting into a triangle on your own terms, you're not doing it off of your back. You're doing it from mount. You're probably doing it for a reason.
Yeah. I mean, he survived, but man, very impressive. So I'm excited to see. He's got those long legs that he was able to get those triangles. But it's nice to see when you the Koreans coming in and doing some work. They come from a long. Koreans have such a good martial arts history in stand up striking. I started with Taekwondo, and the Koreans have a big history in martial arts, so to see them in the UFC and mixed martial arts is going to be impressive. They could probably bring in a good talent. Like, I mean, with Glory going to China now, I got to see these institutes of like 40,000 of these. Their schools are all martial arts schools, Sanxiao, Sanda schools, where there's 40,000 people of these students in these schools, and seeing them like at recess and they're all in like these perfect lines doing forms and patterns. It's just amazing to see. So if they have this system for stand-up striking, if they had something like that for more of their MMA, which is the direction of a lot of combat sports, I mean, they can come up with some amazing talent from these countries, especially China and Korea and such. So I'm excited. I'm excited to see what comes from them.
Yeah, the Korean top team's been around for a while, and they've been producing some great talent.
And again, in Asia, 1FC there. And 1FC, like, they're really huge. Like, seeing some of their shows and watching them sometimes, they're like, there's probably more in attendance at a 1FC show than there is probably at some of the UFCs.
Yeah, and they've got the TV deal in mainland China, which is a big deal. They actually just announced today that the MMA debut of Gary Tonin is going to be happening in April. I think, actually, sorry, in March.
Okay.
In one championship. Do you know about of Gary? Gary's like a big
jiu-jitsu guy. Yeah. I think he won the Eddie Bravo's, right?
Yeah, several of them.
I think he was one of the best, yeah, because I listen to Eddie Bravo stuff sometimes.
Yeah, he lost to Antonio Carlos Jr., but he was like outweighed by 50 pounds.
Yeah, something
along those lines, yeah, if I recall. And Antonio Carlos is also incredibly high level.
But he's going with 1FC?
Yeah, he signed with one.
Good call.
Yeah.
No, I had one of my fighters went to try out for like this 1FC thing, and he was saying there's a lot of good talent out there. It's very hard to get in. And what's fun about 1FC is they take a lot from like Thailand or the Philippines, which are all like Muay Thai style fights. So you're basically getting high level striking with MMA gloves, which is awesome. Some people watch. It's called Cage Muay Thai. Do you know Cage Muay Thai?
Yeah,
you ever seen it? John Wayne Parr puts on a show where it's basically Muay Thai with MMA gloves. So that's what basically 1FC is becoming, a lot of good strikers fighting in MMA gloves, which is what everybody wants to see. So could be good for the sport.
Yeah, a lot of these people that are specialists like John Wayne Parra and Eddie Bravo, who you mentioned, are coming up with good ideas of how to incorporate kind of an MMA rule set or style set and adapt it to their particular sports.
Because, Eddie Bravo started combat jiu-jitsu.
Combat jiu-jitsu, with strikes on the ground.
Which is kind of cool.
Open palm strikes on the ground.
You have to think, if you're maybe a college wrestler or you've done jiu-jitsu for so long, the first thing you don't want to happen is to get hit. That's why you stay there.
Yeah.
So, it is a better transition than, say you are a jiu-jitsu fighter and you want to do MMA. It's probably safer than, a transition than just, hey, go stand up and strike now. You're going to take a lot bigger beating. So I guess it's a way to stay competitive with helping that ground and pound portion, which is a big part of it,
because.
I mean, you can get a jiu-jitsu black belt against maybe a jiu-jitsu white belt, but if that jiu-jitsu black belt doesn't like to get hit and even on some of the ground positions, he's going to give up a lot of submissions because he doesn't like getting hit. So you can take away a black belt from someone by just hitting them. So
One thing I'll say I'm disappointed at is the aftermath of the Kamaru Usman fight, because I thought that he dominated Mech. And it wasn't even a close fight. He then goes on the mic and said, that was me at 30%, What he meant was 30% health, not that he was trying 30%.
Yeah.
And then Dana White kind of misinterpreted that.
I think
and thought
so.
That, yeah, and he thought that, he was saying that he was only going 30%,
yeah.
Which obviously no fighter would ever admit to that, or even, you know, go in with that kind of mindset.
But I just think he was a minus 600, and everyone expected a finish, so he had to come out and say, hey, I didn't finish. But I think the criticism with his, he didn't go for it,
yeah,
right?
But expecting a finish against a guy like Mech is not realistic, because Usman's best tool against a guy like Mech, who's a great striker, and a very dangerous striker, is to take the guy to the ground. And he took him to the ground, and he dominated him on
top. It was the perfect plan.
Yeah, it was the perfect plan. It was the safest plan, and he did get a dominant win. So the fans are booing, the crowd's booing when he's making his speech. And I don't agree with that.
I found the crowd was just tough in general. But
that's true.
I kind of agreed with like Paul Felder saying, and I think the analyst it was Bisping and it was Yves Edwards.
They were
saying like it was a great performance, did well, did everything he had to do, but there were moments like there's a last 20, 30 seconds in the fight and you're on top position, go for it. Throw those elbows a little bit more aggressively. Start doing a little bit more ground and pound. I feel Kamaru Usman should have showed the finish. I felt like when you're in top position, there's a little bit of time left. You got to go for it. Whether you're winning, whether you're not, it just shows that entertainment side. And seeing how... it was a tough crowd. I mean, every time you were winning, the crowd wanted to be entertained that night. And I felt those little moments would have been better for him to not get those boos at his post-fight like he did.
I'll just say this. You know, one thing Dana White said afterwards is, you know, you're fighting an unranked guy. It's like, well, the reason he's fighting an unranked guy is nobody wants to fight him that is ranked. So get the guy a top 10 opponent. Let's see what he's made of. Yeah. You know, if you're not thrilled with his performance, then throw him to the wolves.
Now, do you think he did enough to really solidify himself as a big name in the top 10?
I mean, he is a ranked guy. I think he's already ranked in the top 10, or he's number 12 or something. Yeah. I mean, you can move him up if you want to, if you're somebody doing the rankings. I saw somebody has him ranked as high as 2.
Is he ready for a Colby Covington?
Yeah, sure.
I think so. Wrestling based.
It's an interesting stylistic matchup, because I think that Usman and Covington have similar striking, like the similar level of strikers, similar level of wrestlers. Let's make it happen. Let's see what ends up happening.
And
that'll be a good fight.
And both TSN MMA show alumni. We've had both of them
absolutely.
On. Yeah,
that's
cool.
True.
Yeah, very cool.
I like both of them.
Yeah, me
so
too.
So we'll see what happens. I know a lot of people are soured on Colby Covington, but you know, the guy's just trying to make a name for himself, and people are talking about him now, right?
That's it.
So that's what you need to do, whether it's the right thing to do or not. One guy I was really impressed with in the first round was Michael Johnson. He looked great on the feet at 145. I think he's got a good future at 145, but Darren Elkins just will never go away.
Yeah, Darren, he's just typical Darren Elkins. Like, he did what he's supposed to do. He did what he expected. Take a beating in the first round, come back and win. So I think, man, it's just impressive every time, especially how much beatings he's taken in his career, how much damage he's taken, to continue to do at what he does. Like, even when I saw him at first, I was like, man, he doesn't look good. He doesn't just seem like he's all there and physically, mentally, and then just, man, he fights well. I mean, I guess working at Team Alpha Male and, you know, Uriah Faber's camp and with a bunch of young guys that he probably has rolling with and training with every day has helped out.
Yeah, second longest win streak in the featherweight division behind Max Holloway himself. So we'll see what kind of a step up in competition he gets next.
Yeah, and he ruined my parlay. He ruined my picks.
Yeah, that's true.
Come on, Darren Elkins.
Well, neither of us moved up this week. So
let's talk about your pick, because I'm excited talking about that fight.
Well, Paige VanZant, the problem was she broke her arm in the first round.
Which was crazy.
So that changes the whole fight, right? You don't really know what she's made of, because you don't get to see what she can do. Now, the one thing I will say, and somebody, Casey Layden, who's a videographer for MMA Fighting, pointed this out, he thinks that she's a strawweight that just has a lot of trouble cutting weight to 115. And I think he's right. If you look at her size versus somebody like a Jessica Eye who fought earlier in the card, or her opponent, even
Jessica
Eye
looked
Clark.
Ripped on her way in, too. Like, yeah. I just saw a picture of her. I know she's friends with a friend of mine, Angela Hill. So I saw a picture of her. I was like, oh, man, she was ripped.
Yeah, 125 ripped. Is perfect for Jessica Eye.
Yeah.
I just think Paige is going to be pretty undersized in the division.
I think so. But she came out pretty clear that she was getting, like, body weight issues, right? Which,
yeah.
I mean, it's got
to
be hard.
She had trouble cutting weight.
You know, she's only 23 years old. You know, she's 23 years old. And, I mean, she's still so young. And to go through all of this, and even men, like, I mean, everyone listening, it's crazy to hear. But fighters are some of the most sensitive people. And so they don't have a lot of confidence, because we're used to every picture you see of all your favorite fighters, it's usually at weigh-in, fight day, you're ripped and everything's going on. Now you're tanned, you have the baby oil on in all your pictures. But then off time. You eat. You eat like a regular person. You get bloated, your stomach. And a lot of times, like, I don't really want to take my shirt off now. Everyone expects me to look like a six-pack, mm-hmm. and you don't. So it does play with your mind a little bit. So, I mean, especially being a female, where's that extra pressure on looking, you know, a certain way? It's got to be hard for these girls.
Well, one thing that people had also mentioned is that the UFC is focusing on the wrong prospects. You know, they're pushing Paige VanZant, they're pushing Sage Northcutt when they're just not ready. They're not ready for the big time yet. Not that they're not ready for the UFC, but they're not ready to be considered somebody that could be in championship contention. But at the same time, like, you got to try to
hit that, you know, middle ground, yeah, maybe.
Well, you got to try to elevate your stars, you know, and build stars. But, you know, the problem with building stars in the UFC is it's impossible to do because they need to win fights. Like, you're not gonna build a star if that star doesn't come through.
Yeah, I think we're still in that era where, you know, women's MMA, they want a good-looking girl. And, I mean, it's when sometimes there's a lot of other talent. But I even thought, like, even watching, like, Jessica Rose was a very pretty girl, too. Like, they're both very attractive women. Like, I mean, they got to start really focusing on the skill aspect. But you can't deny, you know, Paige VanZant with all she's done outside of the sport. I think that is the best thing that's ever happened to someone like Paige VanZant or any athlete, is getting that outside exposure. But tough to go through and fight three rounds with a broken arm like that. It wasn't fractured. It was completely broken.
That's
played in screws. Like, I had a similar injury playing football. One of my fighters, Matt Special, had a kickboxing fight. He just had to get played in screws in his forearm. It's an injury that happens a lot. Bones mid-shaft are very weak, so, and there's no way they repair, so that's surgery and plate and screws for Paige VanZant, so she'll probably be out for a good couple months, and probably sensitive for a few years in her training, but adrenaline's good. You don't feel it.
Absolutely. Well, we've got UFC 220 coming up this Saturday, and we're lucky enough to now have Robin Black join us in studio. He's going to touch on UFC 220. I know he's got a lot of thoughts on it. He's been breaking down the card and doing some small one-minute breakdowns on his social media. So if you haven't checked that out, you definitely should. It's Robin Black, at Robin Black MMA, and he joins us right now. Hey, Robin, how are you today?
Hey, good. Good hanging with you guys, always.
So UFC 220 this weekend. I know you've done a deep dive on Francis Ngannou. Now, I'm starting to think that Francis might be in over his head a little bit. Now, hear me out. Stipe made a point that, you know, everybody in the heavyweight division hits, you know, to an extent as hard as Francis Ngannou. If you start thinking about Ngannou on the ground, there's really nothing there, I mean, that we've seen. So now you've got a guy like Stipe who really has a great wrestling pedigree. He's got fantastic footwork, fantastic technical striking. He really could dictate the pace of this fight.
For sure. And there's a second layer to that that I think would concern me if I'm Francis Ngannou fan or his people. And that is, if we get into that scenario, the way he uses energy, he's very much a fast-twitch athlete, right? Mm-hmm. Like, just ultra-fast-twitch athlete. And guys like that, you intentionally train them a particular way to create that kind of explosiveness in short bursts. And it's not... I used to believe this was an overstated thing, that these types of athletes burn out when they start to grind. So I talked to somebody named Dr. Stu McGill, who is the highest level specialist in the nervous systems of athletes. He studied them all. And he said that it's not overstated at all. In fact, you purposefully train an athlete like Francis Ngannou to explode for 30-second bursts over a few minutes, and you purposefully avoid forcing him to grind too much in the gym. You're forcing him to exhaust himself, because you actually alter muscle fibers, nervous systems, alter the athlete.
It'll take a toll on him eventually as well, right? I mean, the first thing with my strength, and what people do, if you, for example, train every day the same thing, you're not giving that nervous system a break. And that's why they say those rest periods are really important, right? Because you're basically not giving your nervous system a chance to recover. So it makes a lot of sense.
So Stipe, you train him like a sprinter. You train him in short bursts of high volume activity, and then you may say to yourself, well, wouldn't it be great? How do we prepare him for rounds 4 and 5? Well, if we do that too much, we start to dig into the things that make him so explosive. So for him to be as fast, explosive, fast twitch, sudden as he is, he, by definition, will not perform well in rounds 3, 4, and 5. He just won't. Yeah. Not like we've seen, anyways.
And you're saying he's saying more genetic basis, right?
Yes.
Because he's got all these fast twitch fibers.
And... Yep. And then I use the term fiber with him, and he's like, Robin, when you say fiber, people will think you mean muscles. And he said, it's not just the musculature, because movement like Stipe has, it begins with a thought. right? Mm-hmm. As Stipe explodes to throw a punch, it begins in his brain. Mm-hmm. And the way that it travels through, it's neurological as well. He's a neurologically different athlete than he would be if you wanted him to perform well in round 3, 4, and 5. So now, Aaron, you're talking about Stipe wrestling him to the ground, fatiguing him in different ways, and if you can wrestle with him and put him on his back a time or two in rounds 1 or 2, now Francis Ngannou's ability to do what he does in 3, 4, and 5 start to disappear. So now we have multiple ways that Stipe can upset the whole world that would love to see. I mean, and right here at TSN, we are building pieces, talking about how Francis Ngannou could be the next great heavyweight, the next great star.
But here's the thing
all
about
those things.
I don't think that that does a disservice to Stipe Miocic, and I don't think that he should be offended by that. I think he should. I think he should, but he shouldn't be. And the reason why I say that is because if they put tons of momentum into this hype train of Francis Ngannou, and Stipe looks dominant in the fight, he's the guy.
I agree.
He's the guy.
Yeah.
Nobody will
doubt it.
And if he's able to finish Francis Ngannou and also make it look easy, which he can do, which I personally think he can make it look easy if things go his way and he does the right thing and he's able to outthink a guy that's a little bit more green. Because keep in mind, when he first started training in MMA, Francis, Stipe was already 4 or 5 fights deep in the UFC.
Yeah.
I mean, this is there's a steep learning curve for Francis to get to the level of experience that Stipe has. Now, that's something you can't teach. You can't teach experience. The only way you can teach experience is by acquiring experience from in-cage experiences. And frankly, Francis hasn't had a lot of them because he wins fights so quickly and so easily.
It's because of his physical dominance, too, right? Mm-hmm. I look at like Brock Lesnar. Brock Lesnar wasn't the most technical, but why is he so good and why is he so effective is because he has that raw power and aggression. Mm-hmm. And I look at it with fighters all the time. If you take someone like Francis Ngannou and if you try to make him overly technical, mm-hmm. you could ruin him. You could kind of take away that explosiveness. You can take away those things. So sometimes that raw, aggressive power, that just not overthinking, not getting over-technical, could be in his advantage. If we start asking Ngannou now to set up punches, maybe that one-punch power is not there. Guys are going to read his distance a little bit better. So I think if you overtrain him too technical, could be a problem for him.
And if you overtrain him to increase his endurance, you will undermine that explosiveness.
Exactly,
So this is a curse. Yeah. The thing that, why are we talking about Francis Ngannou being so special? Because of the things we've seen him do, which are magical and mind-blowing. But that's also the curse that you're describing. How he cannot, as you said, he cannot buy or gain experience from any way other than acquiring it, which he is not acquiring it because he's knocking everybody out. The good and the bad comes with this. When I spoke to his coach, Ferdinand Lopez, who is from Cameroon as well, but trains him in France. Brilliant coach. You'll love him.
He came with him to the UFC Institute, right?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Yes. And you'll love him when you get to talk to him because he's quite brilliant. You're a great coach and analyst, and you love the things. You'll love speaking to this man. Yeah. He talked about shaping Ngannou around his genetic gifts and also around he'll do something which you would look at and most coaches would look at, and it's wrong. Yeah. He'll step a particular way and throw off balance in a particular way, and it's wrong. But it's not wrong because it works for him. And his coach will encourage him to pursue with curiosity these different
things.
Which is very important. He's special. There's no doubt about it. And to Aaron's point, there's no question that it's not wrong to show examples of him destroying Alistair Overeem and Arlovsky, factual moments in time that he really did, and say, this guy is special. If he can do this one more time, he'll be an immense star in the sport. That's all true.
But what happens if he loses now?
Yes. And that's very possible because it's always possible.
We also are guilty of having a recency effect in general. I mean, the last thing we saw of Ngannou was him knocking Alistair Overeem's head clean off his shoulders, pretty much. Yeah. The last thing we saw of Stipe Miocic was, when was it, like last March?
Yeah.
We don't remember. Yeah. He dominated Junior Dos Santos, made him look like an amateur.
Yep.
Junior had no success in that fight. You think back to the fight with Stipe and Overeem. Overeem had some success in that fight. He dropped him. But then afterwards, Stipe got on top and smashed his head into the ground. Yeah. Yeah. We don't remember that. It was a long time ago.
True. And so momentum. You feel that. You feel excitement. You get caught up.
Again, and that's why I think Stipe should really be counting his blessings that there's finally a guy that people think can challenge him. And that they're putting a hype machine behind, because heavyweight is the baddest man on the planet.
Yeah.
And if you can beat the guy that people think is the guy, you're the guy.
You're the guy, yeah.
Yeah. Sure.
I just think he wants a little bit more credit for what he's done because I don't think anyone's really giving him a chance. And I mean, I'm going to come out and say it. I think he's going to win. I think Stipe is going to win this fight. That's my opinion.
I definitely see a Sunday morning where everybody is going, oh, you know, we bought into it too much. I like that term, recency effect. I mean, he just took this guy's head off, and he did it explosively. And if he does that, so let's just say that there's a parallel universe where this fight happens 100 times. And let's say only 9 of them he takes off Stipe's head. In those universes, he's the greatest thing ever. For all time, destroyer, nobody could ever beat him. In the other, let's say it's 40, let's say it's 90, doesn't matter how many it is. In the other one, he doesn't knock out Stipe in the first 2 or 3 minutes. He gets taken down a few times in rounds 1 and 2, and it becomes even easier in 3, 4, and 5, and Stipe finishes him in the 4th. And in that universe, everybody wakes up on Sunday and says, oh, you know, we were overhyped. But we weren't. That guy just about killed Alistair Overeem, one of the great, you know, the great heavyweights of the game.
And I'll say this, regardless of outcome, if this fight goes more than 2 rounds, and Curtis Blaydes doesn't look great against Mark Hunt, or Mark Hunt wins that fight, you could see this fight again in a couple months.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, even if Ngannou wins in the 3rd round and Stipe gives him a good fight, like, you could see an immediate rematch, no problem.
It might be an issue of having him to lower his talent a little bit, build himself up, but guaranteed, he's only, I think, been competing for less than 5 years or something
years.
Like that. So, I mean, there is still a learning curve. There's still a learning curve. And I think the learning curve is going to be Stipe is going to use his IQ. It's going to be a lot of standing clinch wrestling and a lot of grinding, and we'll see.
The reason I called up Dr. Stu McGill to talk about the physiology and the neurology of these athletes is because we are very busy looking at Ngannou, and quite correctly saying that we've never seen an athlete like this. When you watch the way he moves, the way he is putting his core and his techniques and his physical, his athletic platform together in ways that break rules. Yeah. You know, you see the way he puts these combinations together. He's actually generating force by doing things wrong. He's generating more force. And when I say wrong, there are air quotes around it, because it's not wrong when you take Overeem's head off. But that slide of the foot to land that shovel uppercut, there's no textbook in the world that would tell you to do that. And yet he generated more force by doing it because the human body is capable of it. So that's freak athlete. There's no doubt about it. The reason I wanted to talk to this neurologist and this genius about it is because we're forgetting that Stipe is also a freak athlete. He's a freak athlete. He's just a slightly different freak athlete. He has a lot of explosiveness, maybe more than most, just not quite as much as Ngannou. But he's a more general athlete. He's, for a heavyweight, he's a middle distance runner. He can destroy you in rounds 4 and 5. He changes direction in unbelievable ways. And we've never seen one like this, and we've never seen two like this, which is why this fight's so cool.
Well, if you're playing the UFC game and you're going to create a character, you're going to want a character that can be explosive, but a character that can also fight the whole distance. Mm-hmm. So on paper, it's Stipe that has more of the tools and the options, right?
If somehow, and I asked again the world's foremost expert in this area, I asked him, if you saw Francis Ngannou able to do that, to fight the way he is in rounds 4 and 5, what would you think he'd say? I think I just saw something impossible. Because physically speaking, to create what he's creating, he by definition shouldn't be capable of that. Doesn't mean there are exceptions to every rule. But, I mean, I can't see him winning a round 4 or round 5.
No. Here's my hot take of the afternoon. The person that should be most offended by Francis Ngannou getting this massive push is Volkan Ozdemir. He's been in the UFC for less than a year. He just stopped two of the top guys in the division in less than a minute, and nobody's talking about this guy. I mean, the crazy thing about that fight is I don't know what Daniel Cormier is going to study, because with Volkan Ozdemir, we have no tape on this guy. I mean, we've seen what he's done earlier in his career. He's had a lot of fights, but the Volkan Ozdemir of 2 years ago must be vastly different than the Volkan Ozdemir of today. And we don't know what he looks like. We don't know what's going on. We also know that Luke Rockhold's out there training with Volkan Ozdemir, which I'm sure has got to play a little bit of some mental games with Daniel Cormier as well.
I'm a believer, and this could be the biggest upset. I mean, I think this could be a bigger upset than everyone saying the Stipe, but I'm really confident in, you know, I think it could change. I don't think, you know, I'm losing my train of thought here, but I don't think DC is taking it as seriously as he probably should, and I think that one punch power could play a lot of problems.
We went down this road twice with Anthony Johnson, though. with Dan Cormier.
True, yeah. True. We all thought that one fight.
And not to mention that Johnson has better wrestling than Ozdemir, at least that we've seen, because we don't really know what Ozdemir has to offer.
Okay, so when we look at, like, I've been putting together little tape of Daniel Cormier for a couple little breakdowns that I'm doing.
And, which have been great, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I'm doing these little one-minute breakdowns on Instagram, and it's really fun because a lot of the conversation and the analysis of fighting, to really dig in, we have long conversations where we can seek all these different layers. When you go and you look at 1 minute, it's like, this guy knocked this guy out. How did he do it? That, and it really forces you to think a different way. But when I look at Daniel Cormier and I compile all of this stuff, it's like, Josh Barnett at 250 pounds couldn't stop Daniel Cormier from putting him on his back. And Barnett is
a catch wrestler.
He's a genius wrestler. Yeah. You know, Dan Henderson, much smaller, but Volkan isn't actually all that big. You know, Dan Henderson, an Olympian, couldn't stop.
He got body slammed, like a wrestling style body slam.
Yeah. You know, Alexander Gustafsson, who could out wrestle John Jones in moments, couldn't stop Daniel Cormier, who also threw him through the air, up into the air. I mean, so what's the best way you can win this if you're Ozdemir is what he's been doing. Blitzing and putting so much pressure on with power.
Timing the shoot.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Drilling this man.
But at the same time, if you do that, you leave yourself open to the wrestling.
Big time! If I aggressively move forward and Daniel Cormier, while I'm moving forward, times me into the hips or into my body, he will potentially take me down. But if I'm Ozdemir, what else do I do? This is what brought me to the party. Yeah. If I want to knock this guy out, this is what I want to do.
He's going to have to capitalize on that transition. Yeah. He's going to have to, if he can get it, which I think he can. I mean, it's awkward. It could happen. But I don't know. I just see a night of upsets, man. I'm feeling it. Yeah. I'm feeling it.
This is a weird one because
I have a lot of trouble seeing a path for Volkan. I mean, obviously, his path has been his path his last two fights. Yep. But at the same time, Cormier is far from chinny. I mean, the shot that Jones landed on him that took him down was that was chin to chin and you're down. You're done. Yeah. You know, that was the same thing that Holly Holm
has a factor. Do you think DC's age has a factor in this?
Yeah, I mean,
and not to mention that last loss to Jones could have had a big mental toll on him. I mean, we saw what happened to Du Ho Choi yesterday. We don't know what kind of an impact that Swanson fight had on him.
Du Ho Choi, I don't think looked in the shape he's been before. So who knows what he was coming into that fight. And he was fatigued when that happened. There's no question. I watched it back today. He was fatigued by the time that happened. So he stopped moving. And then, you know, all fight for the 7 minutes of good fight or 6 minutes of good fight, two movements back and one off to the right or the left to circle away. And then by the time he was getting hit, it was one step. And
I knew I shouldn't have mentioned Du Ho Choi. Yeah. I knew we were going to go off the rails.
Yeah, I know.
You bring up Du Ho Choi and Robinson.
I'm such a fan. I love And you know, I'm sorry to derail, but I was chatting with people from Korea that are in the fight game who I work with in different capacities, and they were like, you know, the Korean fans are disappointed. They don't think Du Ho Choi improved. It's like, we have a bad tendency as fans of anything and everything, and politics and sport and everything, to look at the result and try to pull meaning out of the result. Result is just what happened tonight.
Yeah.
You know, the result is what happened tonight.
Did Michael Johnson
cut too much weight? Who knows? Yeah. He thought about it. He looked amazing. Did Du Ho Choi's chin give out? Who knows? The results of the moment, they may be unconnected to everything. But same thing, if Ozdemir takes out Dan, is it age? Is it distraction? Is it any of those things? Why do we bring him up? Because they're all possible. I mean, Joe, you love to travel and teach and do commentary and corner, all of that.
Yep.
Can you imagine also being the champion of the world right now while doing all that?
Absolutely.
How hard that would be.
And that's a big concern with a lot of them. Like, even with the Tyrone Woodley, they're saying the same thing for DC. Those guys are working a lot.
Bisping was also working a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, there's a lot.
It does make you a better fighter, too. I'm sure you as a martial artist have improved crazy by being an analyst, right?
Big time. And, I was talking to a kid yesterday, 20 years old, and he showed me a clip of his fight, and he's like, yeah, you know, I noticed he was dipping his head over here. The fight was a minute and a half. He goes, I noticed he was putting weight on that, and as soon as he did, I drew out his right hand and kicked him. I'm like, looking at him like, 20 years old, you know, most 30-year-olds, 7 and 10 years ago, didn't understand, weren't able to get reads like that and understand that. Now, when you go and you fight Ozdemir, is he one of these guys? if he is, you shouldn't have been on those planes and hosting those things and commentating those that stuff and all the things.
The rap on Ozdemir is that he's been in that gym forever with Henry Hooft and all those guys, and he was always like kind of the guy that would really test you in the gym.
Yeah.
And then just he was like a sponge soaking up all this knowledge, and here he is, less than a year later. I mean, you got to give that guy a pat on the back too. As if we're going to be commending Francis Ngannou for getting to where he is as fast as he does. Let's not forget about Volkan Ozdemir here. His story is pretty unbelievable.
Well, win or lose, he still has good fights afterwards, I feel, anyways, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
A Gustafsson fight could be in the works. So, I mean, regardless, if he wins, I don't think there's as much on the line as, like, a Ngannou losing.
I mean, this card, aside from the top two fights, doesn't have a lot of name value, but there's a lot of really good prospects on this card. There's a lot of guys that I think are going to be a big part of the future of the UFC. I mean, you look at Burgos, who we have on the show later on, as well as Calvin Kattar's opponent. Those guys are very young in their career. And have a lot of upside. Thomas Almeida, we've seen what this guy can do. He gets better and better. Rob Font, another guy that's been great at the bantamweight division. I think he lost his most recent fight, but he's a guy to watch. Pantoja, I think, is one of the best prospects at all of flyweight. He's a guy that we should be looking at. And then
and I think Ortiz, who he's fighting, just coming off.
He's really good.
He's a CSA guy in Cali. I know his coach really well. Yeah.
And Julio Arce is a guy that's been huge in the Massachusetts regional scene for a long time. Was considered one of the best prospects outside of the UFC by my buddy James Lynch, who was doing his reports for Flow Combat. So, and he's a guy that competed on the Dana White series, and so is his opponent.
Interesting.
So it's Gleison Tibau is like way down on there.
Just the first fight. Coming out of suspension.
Yeah. Well, I mean.
And same with Islam Makhachev, who's, you know, trains with Khabib, and is, you know, Khabib's gonna be there, you know, cornering Islam Makhachev.
Is Gilson still trying to come in at 155?
Yeah, officially 155.
With this new California trying to weigh in fighters before and after, man, they're probably having heart attacks every time they see what he does.
Yeah, unless I don't remember what it was he popped for, but whatever it is, he won't be taking it now. Maybe he'll be a little smaller.
Yeah,
you know.
It's a very fair point. just a very interesting card. I don't know why you'd put Francis Barbosa on a main card, just because his fights are always very slow and very technical, and it tend to suck the air out of the arena. But John Volante is a fun guy.
I think we are at a point where it's on us, whether we're the commentators of shows, the show themselves, the way that people present things. You know, in the UFC's show, everybody. We got to explain, you know, nobody complains when they watch their football game and their team wins 3-0 and it's all running plays all day, all small, subtle running plays. And because of when fighting became popular and the way that it was presented early on, it was presented from a mindset of spectacle, knockout, crazy, all
just
that kind of
bleed.
Stuff. And man, and that's to a disservice because the fights don't get bigger and crazier forever. They get smarter and more interesting and more delicate or more detailed.
And if you look at Bohoso, he's a master of outpointing guys. Like, he just knows how to beat guys at their own game and knows how to implement the strategies properly. But it's, again, for the fans in attendance, it might not make for the best fight.
Yeah, but if we...
but then again, it's you know, you've got Kattar and Burgos afterwards, which will be a great fight. And I think Almeida versus Font could be the fight of the night.
Yeah, Font, Almeida's a very dangerous guy, but if Font's got his head on him right, like if he's focused right and he's, and you know, he's got, it comes in with good vision to see what Almeida's doing and draw him out and rip him up. Almeida comes forward hard, biting down. It's tough to get hit when you're throwing heavy shots the way he throws them. But that's a really fun fight.
Yeah, I do want to talk about UFC 221. Whitaker pulls out. Now we've got Rockhold versus Romero for the interim belt. That's a fight that we've wanted to see for a long time. You know, obviously very disappointing for the Australian fans as Whitaker was headlining. But at the same time, it's pretty much sold out there. I don't know if people are going to try to get refunds because Whitaker's off the card. But I think at the end of the day, the UFC is still going to do well in terms of the gate. I'm not sure how big of a sell this is going to be on pay-per-view, even with Whitaker on the card. But I think that Romero versus Rockhold is an excellent fight.
Yes, it's a very cool fight. I mean, Rockhold is... we talked about just the brilliance of some of these athletes, what they're capable of doing. Rockhold and Romero are very much in that. You talk to Mike Brown or any of the guys down in Florida that train with Romero, and they're like, this is a guy doing backflips and doing things that 135-pounders do, like the way. But, you know, how did Whitaker beat him? He won rounds 3, 4, and 5.
Yeah.
That's he's the perfect example of what we were saying about of what we were saying about Francis.
Yeah. It would be a great story to see Romero win the title. I think at his age, for him, I mean, that's would he be the oldest champion ever? How old
Randy
was Randy
Couture? I think Randy was 40 or in his 40s.
Yeah, but to do it in a lighter weight class is nothing short of impressive.
No, and it would be cool. I mean, Rockhold is also this brilliant athlete. Like, they're racehorses, man. The two of these guys. But again, I think this is a matchup very much like it. Like, you have the fast twitch neurology and the, you know, the explosive nature, the acceleration of power that Romero has. Rockhold will win fights late. He beat, you know, what round was it where he took out Chris Weidman? Four, maybe?
No,
like
third
three?
Round,
three? Yeah, three? Yeah, four, yeah, yeah. But you see how good he is as the fight wears on, too.
And his IQ is super high also.
Like, I think on his feet and the ground, people really underestimate his jiu-jitsu as well,
Rockhold?
Right? Yeah. And Rockhold, the size of him, people don't understand how big this guy is.
Romero, too.
Yeah, I mean, Romero's more of that stocky build, but you don't realize how big Rockhold is.
Rockhold looks like a heavy.
I've been out with him a few times. Mm-hmm. We've hung out. He's a big guy,
his skeleton, like, where has the size of his, where his shoulders and rib cage and all that. He's a huge dude, and he's some of these guys, you know, these two guys are examples. Stipe and Ngannou are examples. It's unreal what athletically these guys are capable of now. Like, you know, they do things that if we look back at the top guys in 2014 at 135 and what at 145, these guys are moving even better, you know, which is crazy for athletes of this size. Do you have some young guys that are 200 pounds that are blowing your mind what they're able to do?
Well, I have my young guy. Well, he's a glory fighter, kickboxer, Rob Thomas. Mm-hmm. Like, you got to see him. You call this fight his MMA fight. And now the kid is just seeing him. He's like 24. He's literally now, like, he's walking around bigger than Luke Rockhold. Jeez. We have him lifting, eating properly, strength. Like, he fights at 185. He's walking right now almost 215, 220.
It's and then crazy the way they move, too, kids. Like, they're big, but the way that they're light on their feet and the way that they're fluid, it really is. And then when you track how and why that is, at first you're like, well, I guess there's better athletes coming over. You know, they know more. But the coaching is better. What they saw from younger is better. When you're 17 and the fighters you see are the fighters now, that's the base for you. Yeah. That's the base of what seems possible. So by the time you become 22,
it's a higher baseline.
It's starting at, you look and you go, okay, I see what Romero does. He's just a human. I can probably learn to do that. And so what's, you know, and the same thing when Tony Hawk suddenly could do four spins or whatever on the skateboard. Yeah. After that, every kid could learn to do that.
They did it.
The quad and figure skating became possible by everybody.
But it takes that one person. I think what really changed footwork in this last year or two was Vasyl Lomachenko.
Yes.
Everybody's watching these guys like Lomachenko, and you watch all these fighters. Yeah. I think Max Holloway, after his fight, was like, he went to go see Lomachenko. Yeah. He, on his post fight, like, I've been doing the Lomachenko step in. Like, so sometimes fighters really need to, like, have that influence. Like the front kick when Belfort knocked out
Anderson. And then Machida
did it. Then Machida did it. And then Jean-Claude Van Damme saying he's been doing it for years.
Who was it? That
Cody Garbrandt.
Who was Duho? Duho kicked.
Oh, the front kick.
I thought you were talking
Duho
about Van Damme and Cody Garbrandt.
Yeah. Duho landed that big front kick on
the front kick. I mean, it takes sometimes one person to do it, and then everyone's going to follow around.
Right, one thing I want to get to, actually, we have to get wrapped up soon, our picks.
Yeah.
So we both lost. I had Paige VanZant, who broke her arm in the first, unfortunately. Yeah. No excuses. And he had a parlay with James Krauts and Michael Johnson. Michael Johnson looks great in the first.
Yes, he did.
Unfortunately, got caught.
My guy James is a smart fighter, man.
Yeah, he's a friend of mine.
He's
a friend of mine. Yeah. He's very connected. Yeah.
Yeah, I love him. He's a great guy. Very, very smart. I sat down and hung out in Winnipeg. He was cornering.
He was there in Winnipeg.
He was cornering somebody. I forget.
And Robin, unfortunately, your last bet was on Jorge Masvidal against Stephen Thompson, so you're bankrupt.
I'm bankrupt. I put it all.
So who you got, Joe? Who you got
for 2020? Okay, I have to take a quick.
Unless you want to do bankroll for 2018, I'd be happy to get it.
Sure, bankroll.
Get him back.
Yeah, you're. What do you guys do? Just pick one?
We pick a, we
you can
pick
do a
lines.
Parlay. Yeah, or
do you have someone yet, or do you want me to go ahead?
Go ahead, because I'm going to go with the courageous call. I right away, yeah. I'm very confident on that 160 on Stipe.
Yeah.
I'm going to do one fight I was going to only do on Stipe. I've been confident. I felt it. I'm going with it.
I'm going for a deep cut. I'm going with Marina Moroz at minus 130. I think her size over someone like Jamie Moyle is going to play a massive factor. And I think she just has a lot more weapons. I think Moyle, you know, if she does try to wrestle with Moroz, Moroz is really crafty off of her back. I think Moroz is a better striker. I just think that this line is a little bit too low for Marina Moroz.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting bet, but I like the way you're thinking. So, how much you bankrolling me, Aaron?
I'll give you another. We'll give you $10.
Yeah, okay, $10.
That's how much we each get.
First of all, let me preface this by saying you know that I think picking fights is folly.
Yep.
A madness. I think it's madness. There's so many variables. Having said that, let's throw my $10 to the wind.
Disclaimer. Yeah.
I think DC is going to be able to get Ozdemir on his back and then take him out in a couple of rounds.
Taking the biggest chalk on the
ground. Yeah, but you're not gonna
I was gonna stack it with either. I'm having a hard time, but I'm gonna lean one way at random as I do with either Stipe or Francis. I think Stipe is going to take Francis out in the third or fourth round.
Okay,
I do.
I think we all like Stipe in that fight. Yeah. That's surprising because I mean Stipe is the underdog.
Yeah. How big of an underdog is he?
He's been plus 160.
Some people are going to make some money on that,
I think.
There's no doubt.
Some people will lose a lot of money.
Exactly.
There's also emotion into these things, right? Because what would you rather be? Just like almost off or just way off? Like, let's say...
I'd rather be way off.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Like, if you take Stipe and he gets Pez dispensered in the head like Overeem did, you'll be like, well, I was wrong.
And it was fun to watch.
Yeah. And it was fun to watch. Yeah. If you lose on your Stipe, and again, I do not only do I not bet on fighting, I recommend nobody ever do it. but if you were to bet on Stipe, if you're going to lose your money, it's going to be in spectacular fashion.
Yeah, so. I agree.
All right. Well, one individual. Do you know who the only undefeated person is on this card, Robin?
The only undefeated, like in the
whole
game?
There's only one fighter who's undefeated in this entire card.
Undefeated in MMA?
No, in MMA on UFC 220.
Yeah. It is not Francis. He has a loss. No, I don't. No, I do not.
It's our next guest, Shane Burgos, who joins us now on the TSN MMA show. Here is our interview with Shane Burgos.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's time to introduce this week's guest.
All right, we're now joined by the only undefeated fighter on this weekend's UFC 220 card. It's not Stipe Miocic. It's not Francis Ngannou. It's Shane Burgos joining the show. How are you, Shane?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah, our pleasure, for sure. You know, the good thing about you, Shane, is, you know, you're not just a fighter. You're also someone who follows the sport so closely and intimately. You love the sport. So before we get started, I did want to hear your opinion on last night's card, Elkins versus Michael Johnson, great featherweight fight, as well as the main event, obviously, Jeremy Stephens and Duho Choi.
Awesome fights. Both of them were great fights, honestly. Stephens versus Choi, that was a great fight. Stevens coming back and making some changes after that first round, it was a close first round. It was probably one of the harder rounds I've had to judge. But Stevens made some great adjustments in the second round, and he got that finish. I thought it was a good stoppage, too. Some people were complaining about the stoppage, but you see after he landed that bomb on the ground, Choi was... He was done, man. It made no sense for him to take any more brain damage at that point.
Yeah, I thought it wasn't what was impressive with Stevens was his footwork, man. Seeing the way he shifts his stance to close distance was what really impressed me. Do you play around with stance switching in your training or what?
Yeah, 100%. Yes, exactly. I do it a lot. I don't do it too much in my fights, but I definitely do it a lot in training. I'm always trying to evolve, so I think you'll see a little bit more in my next couple fights for sure.
So you're a New York guy. You're going into hostile territory this weekend, UFC 220 in Boston against the Boston finisher. Give me your thoughts on Boston as a New Yorker. What do you think of the city?
I love it, actually. It's a really nice city. I've been there twice already when I was younger. I went there for two UFC events, actually, and for a fight, the UFC Fan Expo. I was there back when I was a teenager. So it's an awesome city, a lot of good food. The sports fans are pretty crazy, so it should be interesting.
I thought New Yorkers were supposed to hate Boston. What's going on? You got to give us something here, Shane.
Nah, man. Honestly, I'm not a big baseball guy. I know the rivalry with the Boston Red Sox and the Yankees. I could care less about baseball, so no rivalry. I don't care.
I mean, you did beat Charles Rosa, so you've already done your civic duty as a New Yorker to beat up somebody from Boston, and now you're gonna have to try to do it again with Calvin Kattar.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm gonna keep it rolling. I'm 1-0 against Boston, so I'm looking to make it 2-0.
How do you plan on taking this fight with Kattar?
I plan on finishing it. soon as the fight starts, as soon as the referee says go, my job is to seek and destroy and look for that finish.
Are you looking more on the ground, on the feet? What are you guys preparing for?
No, it's going to be a stand-up fight. I feel like I could take it to the ground. I mean, don't get me wrong. If there's a takedown there, I will go for it, and I'm not scared to grapple with anybody. So I think I could grapple with anybody, but I want a knockout. So if I can get that, that'd be awesome. If don't get me wrong, if I drop him and his neck is there, I'll choke him too. So I just want to finish, honestly.
So with New York being mentioned, there's also rumors of a potential card in April in Brooklyn. Is that a card you'd like to get on if you're successful this weekend? Or, I mean, even if you're not, if you come out kind of, you know, uninjured, is that a card that you're looking ahead to?
Yeah, like you said, as long as my body's good and I'm uninjured, then it's Brooklyn. I mean, I fought so far. This is my fourth fight on the East Coast. Three of them being in New York. If this one, this next one's in New York, that'd be crazy, man. I bring a lot of people out. I got a lot of fans, like not even calling fans, like a lot of friends, a lot of family, a lot of teammates, a lot of training partners that come out. And if it's in Brooklyn, I'm going to pack the place out.
You know, one thing I wanted to ask you about is on Twitter, I follow you, and I've noticed you keep posting pictures of food porn. I mean, you're trying to cut weight for this event. What's the deal with that? What's with all these pictures of foods you probably can't eat right now?
Oh, yeah, everybody asks me that. It's like a weird, like, fetish or something. I don't know. When I'm hungry and I can't eat what I want to eat, I like to watch the Food Channel, and I like to watch, like, Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives.
Oh, yeah, that was my favorite.
I like to eat my boring food while I watch that, and it kind of, like, mentally stimulates me. It makes it a little bit easier.
How much do you cut weight for your fights? Do you have a lot of weight to cut, or?
This is probably, I'd say, hands down, one of my best weight cuts ever. I'm only about 10 pounds, not 10, like, no, 9 pounds now, 9 Eight and a half, 9 pounds out, so I'm feeling great.
And what do you walk off camp at?
I was walking around at 175 in August.
Okay, 30 pounds, yeah.
But I got to go back to this food porn thing because it's kind of weird. So you enjoy looking at the pictures of this food, knowing you can't have it because it almost gives you like, what does it give you, like a stimulation knowing that you're going to get to eat it in like 2 weeks?
Yeah, it's like a mental stimulation. Like I said, I like to eat my food while I look at it, while I watch the food, because it's like mentally, like I'm eating it, but I'm seeing something else. So it's kind of like, I don't know, it does something to me. But yeah, I'm obsessed with food, and I feel like you don't appreciate food until you had to cut weight.
Joe, have you heard of this?
I have friends who actually buy people things they want to eat so they can see them eat it, and I was like, all right, that's a little like intense, but. I'm at the point now, since I'm not currently fighting, I love, like, eating in front of my fighters. I'm like, man, I did this for too long. I'm eating burgers in front of them. I rub it in their faces. I did it for too long.
You earned that.
Yeah, I could sit there and I could eat my fries and burger in front of them. I don't care.
I got to stop taking this stuff for granted. I just eat whatever I want. Yeah.
Tell me, go through a weight cut. You'll understand. I've been trying to get Aaron to cut some weight here. He doesn't want to do it. I'm trying to get a mock weight cut.
I'm thinking of going down.
Just so you know, for the podcast.
I'm thinking of cutting to bantam weight.
That's it. You should.
I'm telling you, I think everybody should, because it will give you a whole new appreciation for food. It really will.
Oh, and I said that commissions. Anyone who works for a commission who's running weigh-ins should cut weight, because when every minute that they're late and they're taking their time, it's the worst.
That's a great point.
Everyone in the commission should cut weight.
I'm still waiting for a fighter to ask for a towel at, like, the official weigh-ins, like the ones that are the ceremonial weigh-ins, rather. Someone just call out for the towel. Why not, Jay? Everybody knows that you've made the weight already. It would just be a funny thing to do.
Maybe I'll do it for you.
Set that up for. I tried to get Elias Theodora to do it, but he wouldn't do it. I know you're a big fan of the sport, as I mentioned earlier. I'd love to just throw some topics at you, just to get your take on it. Are you up for that? Or are you too focused on Calvin Kattar?
I'm 100% focused, but yeah, we can have some fun.
All right, so Conor, who should he fight next and why?
Who should he fight next? He's 100% should be fighting Tony, because Tony's the interim champ. So, I mean, that's the only thing that really makes sense. And if we're playing the sport and we're being, I mean, if we're being the way the sport should go, he should fight Tony Ferguson next.
All right, so hypothetically, a lot of people are saying Khabib might be fighting Ferguson next at this card in Brooklyn. Dana White yesterday was asked about it. Did we send out a press release about that? So I'm guessing that's kind of on the horizon, and that Conor might be stripped of the belt. So let's say Conor's not the champion. Then what? Like, do you have a guy that you would love to see Conor fight?
Yeah, Nate Diaz again. I'm a huge Nate Diaz fan, so I would love to see them run that back. And, I mean, you got to do the third one. The first one, Nate won, obviously. The second one, I honestly thought Nate won. It was a close fight, but I thought Nate won. So why not do a third one?
Yeah, I actually watched his documentary the other day, that McGregor documentary. Did you guys watch it?
No, I haven't seen it yet.
It was okay.
All right.
It was okay.
not a ringing endorsement.
Nothing but
okay.
Nothing that, like, we don't know already. That was the thing. That's my point. So.
All right. So Holloway, let's say he beats Edgar. Who's next at featherweight?
That's a good question. I mean, Brian Ortega's right there, but so is, I mean, Jeremy Stephens is calling for a fight with Brian Ortega, so I guess maybe the winner of that could fight him, but it looks like Brian Ortega's next.
Ortega's undefeated, one of the other few undefeated guys at featherweight like yourself. So who's your dream opponent for 2018? You can fight anybody at featherweight.
I don't know, man. Calvin Kattar, honestly. That's my focus right now, so that's what I'm thinking about. I'm not really thinking about me fighting anybody else. My focus is strictly on this dude. If I overlook him, I'll be an idiot. The guy is not a slouch. He's not a scrub. It's not going to be an easy fight. It's going to be a tough fight. So I'm thinking about him 100%.
And outside of you, what's your dream fight for 2018 of any two competitors in the UFC?
I really love that Khabib versus Ferguson fight. That's an awesome fight. I mean, it's been scheduled like what, 3 times now. We haven't seen it, so I definitely want to see that fight. That's an awesome fight.
They say fourth time's a charm.
Yeah, the Stipe versus Ngannou fight, which is on my card. That. Who doesn't want to see that fight, right?
That's crazy. You know, the crazy thing about that division is I don't know who's next after that. I mean, like, Verdum's in the mix, but, you know, Stipe's beaten him already. If Ngannou wins, you could see Ngannou versus Verdum. And I'm interested to see what happens with Curtis Blaydes and Hunt.
I just think it's crazy that no heavyweight has defended the title more than 2 times, which is shocking
to
me.
And the belt has been around since
the
beginning.
And it was Kane, right? Kane only had 2 title defenses.
Yep.
That's pretty
wild. That shows, like, heavyweight is such a dangerous division to be in. So if somebody can even defend it, if Stipe can defend it 3 times, I mean, he does go down in history as the best heavyweight of all time.
Absolutely. And what's your favorite UFC fight ever?
My favorite fight
in history?
That's hard to pick.
Yeah, I chose the toughest question for last.
Yeah, that's a hard one. I can rattle off a couple off the top of my head. I really like the Nate Diaz versus Conor McGregor fight. Those were great fights. What else we got? I loved Korean Zombies fight with what's his name?
The Spanish guy?
Dustin Poirier, and the fight with Leonard Garcia.
Yeah, Garcia, that's who it was, yeah.
A couple other ones. I don't know if you guys remember this fight, John Lineker versus Louis Gadino.
Oh, yeah, that's an old school
one. That was an awesome fight. That's my teammate, Louis Gadino.
That's one of the first flyweight fights.
Yeah, exactly. It was an awesome fight. Back and forth on the feet, throwing bombs, and Louis pushing to sleep with the guillotine. Great fight. Another old fight, Jared Rollins. I always talk about this one because nobody ever talks about it. Jared Rollins versus War Machine.
Oh, wow. That's a really old one. Yeah.
That's really
old. War Machine had a title race from history, but just continue.
Yeah. That fight was insane, though. And then you got Clay Guida versus Roger Huerta was later on that card, too, and that was an awesome fight.
Yeah. Clay's had some barn. Like Clay versus Diego Sanchez is one of my favorite fights. Yeah. I love that fight.
Awesome fight. Yeah, it's hard to pick one. I don't think I ever picked one, but yeah, I got a bunch.
Yeah, even a fight I mentioned on Twitter that people should go back and watch, I mentioned yesterday, was Kyung Ho Kang fight yesterday. His last fight against Tanaka was unbelievable. That was kind of like an undercard fight in Tokyo or somewhere along those lines.
Didn't even see that one. Yeah, look at me.
Yeah, you should go back and watch that one. That's an awesome fight.
Yeah.
As someone in the lighter weight classes, you'd probably really appreciate it. Well, we appreciate you. Thank you for joining us, Shane. We'd love to have you on sometime when you don't have a fight lined up just to shoot the breeze with us.
That sounds awesome, for sure.
That was Shane Burgos, again, the only undefeated fighter on UFC 220. It'll be interesting to see if he can keep that alive. A little bit of housekeeping here. UFC 220 prelims, they air at 8 o'clock Eastern on TSN2. This Saturday, Robin Black will be on SportsCenter breaking down all of the action from UFC 220 with pre- and post-fight coverage. I'll be down in Boston. I'll have a great one-on-one with Dana White coming later this week on Friday. And also, keep your eyes open for the TSN MMA show Extra. What I usually do is when I'm on site for an event, I'll compile some of the interviews from Media Day and make it available in podcast form. Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Thanks to our guests, Shane Burgos and Robin Black, and we'll be back next week.
Thanks for listening to the TSN MMA show. For all the latest UFC news, visit tsn.ca/UFC.